writer-producer, Lawrence O'Donnell. Next, on The Culture Catch. Today's episode is brought to you by Scriptwriters Showcase, Script Magazine, and our friends at FinalDraft.com. Lawrence, welcome to The Culture Catch.
Thank you.
Tell me about yourself. How did you get into the writing profession?
I wrote a book in the 80s that got turned into a TV movie, and so that got me into the TV writing business, and I've been working on The West Wing since the first year. I did 2 years at The West Wing, then I left for 2 years and created my own show. Then that one went off the air after a season, and then I went back to The West Wing for the final 3 years.
Did anyone working on The West Wing expect the reaction, the devotion to the show? Take me back to the first year you're on there.
I think a bunch of people working on The West Wing expected it to be a hit because they knew what a high quality show it was. That's the reason I expected it to fail. I thought it would go maybe 5 or 6 episodes and get canceled. But the audience found it, the audience loved it, and the audience gave it 7 years. And there's no one more surprised by that than I am.
Take us through the writing process, because I think a lot of people that are listening to this don't know the machinations of what it takes to write a high-quality television show.
Well, television is a group writing exercise. At the West Wing this year, we have a staff of about 5 or 6 writers, and each one gets assigned a different script. We, as a group, figure out what the content of each episode will be. There's usually a series requirement in the episode, meaning there's something that has to happen in episode 14 that will lead to something that happens in episode 15. But that will usually only take up about, say 10% of the story. The rest of it we have to figure out on an episode-by-episode basis, and we do that as a group. We outline it as a group, and then we send off one of the writers to do the first draft of that script, and then that writer will take it through probably as many as 4 drafts before we then shoot the episode.
But I mean, you guys are also you're listening to what's happening in the paper, the news. You're slaves to reality because you want to add that. Mm-hmm. That reality to your programming and
to
your show.
Yeah, I think more than most shows, The West Wing was dependent on being aware of everything that was happening in the world. We would do stories about tariffs on Chinese-made bras, for example, and what's going on.
A little-known news story, I might add.
Well, but if you were reading the business section of the New York Times, you would have noticed that there were maybe a dozen stories about that in the course of a year.
Right.
And how that was interacting with the White House. And so, yeah, we were frequently ripping stories from the headlines, but they weren't the headlines that most people read.
Right. Do you guys think you purposely were going for those to just make it more compelling so people couldn't just say, oh, this is an easy story. This is an easy episode to write. It's all over the news? Or
no, we were... It was always hard to write a West Wing because it doesn't have any of the conventional assets of hour-long TV drama. There's no baby dying in the emergency room, and there's no one on trial for murder, and there's no one in a car chase, and no one gets shot. And so those are things that are very helpful to have in a TV drama. We didn't have any of that. All we had were people in business clothing disagreeing with each other. And the challenge was, how do you turn that into something compelling? So we were straining at the writing of every single one of those episodes.
What typically begins a writing day, a writing session? Look, you start on a Monday morning. You guys are all in a room. Somebody has an idea. You throw the ideas around.
No, it's actually much more organized than that. There's a meeting schedule that typically on the West Wing would be two or three meetings a week with all of the writers in the room, at least a three-hour meeting where we sit down and plan what we're going to do over time. And we're never, because we do it far in advance, we're never under a very intense pressure to come up with any particular thing on a given day. If we don't figure out how to solve a certain problem that day, we're usually pretty confident that we'll solve it in the next meeting. It's not the kind of show that's written with our backs to the wall under intense time pressure. Most TV shows are written that way. The West Wing is written in a very careful, planned basis so that we never find ourselves in a panic to get a script done or to get a story figured out. We've always done it in a carefully planned way. That's in the last 3 years. In the first 4 years, it was much more a matter of writing in the last minute and in a panic operation. And as the show matured, we figured out how to do it in a reasonable way so that everybody could have fairly predictable time commitments to the job, actually.
Right. The actors, an amazing ensemble. I think as a writer, you must feel incredibly fortunate to be working with such fine actors and actresses.
I think we have the best cast in commercial television, and that has made the writing better than it deserves to be on its own. Every single script that we sent down to the set was made significantly better by the cast and by the directors of those episodes. They just make mediocre writing look really good, and they make good writing seem great. And we just wouldn't be half as successful or successful at all as a television show without that cast.
Do you ever face the frustrations when you have an actor perhaps not getting conveying what you're trying to put forth?
I'm not frustrated by that. I'm intrigued by that. I have a certain notion for how a scene should be played. And when I go down to the set and I see an actor doing it a different way, nothing could interest me more. And I'm always hoping that what the actor comes up with is better than what I was thinking of doing. Most of the time, that's the case. Only once in a while, a guest actor on the show would approach a scene in a way that I just couldn't see how that would work effectively, and only then would I get in there and make a different suggestion about it. But with Allison Janney, whatever you have in mind for her to do is fine, but what she does will be better than anything you dreamed of. So if you see Allison Janney doing a scene in a way that you had not anticipated, you should shut up and enjoy it. And that's true of Brad Whitford and Janelle Maloney and Martin Sheen and the dear John Spencer and Alan Alda, Jimmy Smits, Richard Schiff. These actors are extraordinary talents, and they were always giving us the gift of making the writing better.
Do you think perhaps a good many of them had such strong theater backgrounds that helps?
You know, some of them didn't have any real theater background. I think that's an exaggerated element in what we consider quality acting. You know, they're just great artists, and we didn't know how great they were when we started off. We had a feeling for it, but we kept giving them difficult material, and they kept doing the difficult material in a way that was better than what we anticipated, and put touches on it that we could never have dreamed of. You know, the best way to write a West Wing script is to not put any adjectives in it at all, nothing in it that directs the actors in any way. Mm. You know, no parentheses under the character name,
right.
You know, that says sad or, you know, smiles or none of that.
Right.
You know, I mean, I've written scenes where I could imagine Alice and Janney, for example, crying in the scene, and instead she was smiling, and it was much better. Because of that completely opposite choice than was in my head. So the best way to deliver a script to actors like that is with absolutely no direction written into the script at all. The reason we do write direction into the scripts for the most part is to make the network executives understand what they're supposed to feel, you know, when they witness this scene.
Great answer. I wanted to ask you, that's a good lead into my next, the censorship issues. You know, a lot of people may say that these conglomerations could pressure, you know, you to maybe resolve a conflict differently than you would like to in a series, in an episode. Have you felt any of that?
Never once. NBC never once said a word about any content of a West Wing script. Same thing with Warner Brothers, which owns the show and is a giant, part of a giant conglomerate, AOL, Time Warner.
Right.
And so, you know, there's two massive corporate interests involved in producing The West Wing and delivering it to an audience, and neither one of them has ever said a word about anything we've done. We've had things in it that were critical of pharmaceutical companies that are big, big advertisers on NBC. And NBC never complained, never suggested we should do something else. And, you know, that's the funny thing about the, you know, so-called censorship elements of commercial TV. It's really only concerned with nakedness and language and profanity. It doesn't have an interest in anything else. You can kill...
Violence is fine, right?
Yeah, you can kill anybody any way you want to, and you can rape anybody you want to as long as you don't, you know, get too graphic with the sex.
Unless you show their nipple at the Super Bowl.
Yeah, and so, you know, in the West Wing, you know, all of the, you know, stuff that, you know, might have been considered controversial and was not considered controversial because everybody involved in the scene had their clothes on, you know, and they didn't say anything profane, you know. So, you know, it's a kind of silly area of TV. Commercial television is the most constrained human speech that has ever been invented. There isn't a single police officer in the history of commercial television who has ever used a word of profanity. Now, how fucking crazy is that?
That is unreality.
You know, there's not a single drug dealer criminal in the history of commercial television who has ever used a word of profanity. That's a complete fantasy land to begin with.
It is.
So people who start to get excited about, oh, gee, the FCC won't let us show this or show that, are crazy. They are people who are working in an extremely censored environment who suddenly complain about censorship because the FCC is excited about how many teenagers are dry humping each other in a, you know, Without a Trace episode. Well, there's not a single cop in Without a Trace who's ever spoken the way a cop speaks.
Right.
So what else, you know, it's a censored form.
But then you get into...
In which people make a tremendous amount of money and thrive within this censored form. And every once in a while, they like to complain about pretending as if they're suddenly being censored when they're being censored all the time.
Right. I guess you have to move into cable to get into the reality. Shows like The Shield and obviously The Sopranos.
The Shield is a censored show too.
To an extent, but I think it's a
little bit. To a tremendous extent.
Yeah.
Tell me the cop on The Shield who said fuck.
Well, that's the only word you're not allowed to say, I think.
That's a lot of words.
Yeah, I guess it is.
How many fucks are there in a Sopranos episode?
Quite a few.
That's a lot of words.
And in Deadwood.
Yeah.
Very good point. Very valid point.
It's very fake. It's all very fake. Everything we do in commercial TV is fake. The nice thing about a show like The West Wing is that you don't miss the profanity and
Absolutely.
You don't miss the nudity because it is placed in a setting where you don't expect it. Now, Bill Clinton, you know, alone in a room with, you know, a couple of people, was a very profane person.
Right.
So was Lyndon Johnson.
Right.
But, you know, the current president isn't.
Right.
It's if you went into the real White House today, you would never hear a word of profanity.
Well, maybe
from
Dick.
Anybody.
Maybe Dick Cheney would. I don't know.
And, you know, so it's not as big a leap, you know, in a show like The West Wing to have everybody keep their clothes on and not be profane. But in, you know, in a lot of other shows, it's just absurdly censored, you know, all the time.
Right.
In a way that the creators and writers of the show don't even think of as censorship.
Very good answer. I guess it's the subtlety of the nuances of the human relations that make The West Wing so vital then for many people. And the many power struggles and the machinations, I guess people don't know really how our government works, even on a very simple level, how the, you know, the House, the Senate, the judicial branch all work together. So coupled with the great acting and those nuances of just human relations in that setting.
Well, I would hope no one watches The West Wing to learn about government. I think there are books for that, and nothing saddens me more than I hear once in a while some high school classes using episodes of The West Wing to teach civics, and I just think this is a disaster. Mm. This is ridiculous because the truth is that most of the stuff in The West Wing is kind of fake in its way, mm-hmm. and some of it is outright screamingly false.
Right.
And we get away with it because people think the show is so realistic.
Right.
Realistic is different from real. Realistic is a feeling.
Mm-hmm.
You can look at fake marble and say it looks very realistic. It's fake, you know. So, most of The West Wing is pretty fake stuff. Passing for realism. And I'd hate the idea that anybody tried to actually take their lessons about American government or politics from The West Wing, because they'll end up knowing nothing real.
Well, it's really a sad indictment about the teaching. So few kids read, and so much of the media pushes a lot of education forward. Not in all schools, but in many, you know, let's face it, the TV has become a conduit for educating the masses.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the fall of the Roman Empire, perhaps.
Well, you know, commercial TV is a terribly contorted forum. You know, no one should be expecting it to come up with really interesting stuff. It's accidental when that happens.
Right.
It's not in the nature of it. You know, Donald Trump is very much in the spirit of commercial TV. Game shows are very much in the spirit of commercial TV.
Right.
You know, the stupidest soap operas are the most successful kinds of commercial TV all over the world.
Right.
And it's entirely accidental that something interesting or enriching ends up on commercial TV. That's just an accident. And if the audience finds it and keeps it alive, then that's just a lucky continuation of an accident.
What writing do you enjoy on television?
Everything, all the good stuff is on HBO. And that's not surprising. You know, they don't have to conform each episode to be 44 minutes and 20 seconds like you have to do on an hour, a so-called hour of commercial TV, or 22 minutes for a so-called half hour of commercial TV.
Right.
So HBO works in a very, very sensible way, and they let people say what they would say under the circumstances, and they don't get, you know, all excited about it, and they don't try to falsify the language, and so it's, you know, it's a very creative place, obviously, and so that's where I think all the really good stuff is being done, and they have a tremendous advantage in doing really good stuff. I mean, they can actually specifically set out to do something really good.
Right.
You can't do that in a commercial network. You have to specifically set out to get a lot of eyeballs for
right.
your commercials, because that's what's keeping you alive. You do not care how good Donald Trump is. You don't care. And if you start to get worried about how good your stuff is in commercial TV, you will go out of business.
How about growing up? What shows were you a fan of? Or shows?
I wasn't a big TV fan growing up. It just wasn't something that attracted me very much. I mean, I was much more interested in the Tonight Show and
sports,
what Johnny Carson was doing, than anything else. I mean, that's the only thing I was regularly interested in on TV.
Right.
You know, and it was a general kind of cultural agreement at the time that commercial television was terrible. And that wasn't a controversial thing to say or think. And so, you know, I can't really... Television didn't really start to interest me a great deal until HBO started doing series. When HBO did Larry Sanders,
right,
I was stopped cold because this was instantly the finest thing in the history of TV. And, you know, they've since come along with The Sopranos and Six Feet Under. And
well, they seem to own Sunday nights now.
No, not in real numerical terms. They get the rating.
Not ratings, but I think.
For example, the rating that Big Love gets on HBO on a Sunday night, which is considered a hit for HBO, is lower than the rating that The West Wing now gets on a Sunday night on NBC. And The West Wing's rating is so low that NBC cannot keep the show on the air. So that's a completely different business. HBO is in a completely different
business.
Well,
they are. They're subscription-based, and they're not driven by advertising, so they don't have to worry about it.
Well, you know, they made a tremendous amount of money on The Sopranos because they were able to measure that The Sopranos increased their subscriptions by 5 million. Now, that's 5 million people paying $10 a month, so that's $50 million every month. Forever. That isn't going to stop when The Sopranos goes off the air.
No.
So HBO owes David Chase and Jimmy Gandolfini, you know, like $50 million a year to just start things off.
Who will get the syndication to that?
There is no syndication.
Never.
That's
ever?
Why it's a more complicated business.
Ah, interesting.
There is no syndication because you can't syndicate a thing where everyone's saying "fuck you"
that's
12 seconds. You know, because you can't. You can't get that dialogue onto local, you know, TV affiliates in St. Louis at, you know, 4 o'clock in the afternoon. So it'll never syndicate. It makes real money in DVD sales, which most television doesn't. And they pay, you know, they pay much higher fees to the actors and to the writers and the directors, not directors, but to the creators of those shows. They pay much higher fees in the actual production of it than they do in commercial TV. But in commercial TV, guys like Jerry Seinfeld, you know, make $400 million in one day.
Right.
The day that thing sells to syndication, Jerry Seinfeld, you know, makes an amount of money that no one at HBO will ever make.
Right. Well, see, my theory is, and someone who is in this domain, is The Sopranos is perfect for the internet and for the applications because there's no gatekeeper.
Right.
You can flip the switch. You can charge whatever you'd like to charge.
Right.
And now you've got a global reach that it even surpasses HBO's wildest dreams.
Yeah, that will be part of it. They will move to that with their programming, and that will work very well for them. But you know, it's not surprising that a network comes along that drops all of the constraints that commercial TV puts on writing. And their product ends up being better and more entertaining. That shouldn't be surprising to anybody.
Any new books that you're working on?
No, I suppose end up creating another show for commercial TV sometime in the next year.
You're not showing us your hand at all?
No, I don't have much of a hand. I haven't really thought about it very much. I mean, there's different ideas that are in the back of my mind, but I haven't really thought about it very much because I've been just committed to getting the final season of The West Wing done.
Right.
And, you know, I've had different things that have passed through my mind over the years, but nothing that I've actually bothered to write a sentence about. And, you know, and now, after a little bit of a rest, you know, now I'll just sit down and concentrate on that and move on to the next subject. And there's a movie project I have going and probably another movie project after that. And so there'll be enough typing for me to do for the next couple of years anyway.
Well, thanks for being on the Culture Cast. Very enlightening.
A pleasure. Thank you very much.
Thank you. should I swear to fab words?
Today's episode was brought to you by the Scriptwriters Conference, Script Magazine, our friends at FinalDraft.com, and WebHSP. For all of your web hosting needs, it's WebHSP.com. This is Dusty Wright for The Culture Catch. Stay tuned for many more amazing pod and vidcasts from Culture Catch, including Gore Vidal, the graffiti artist Saber, actor Alec Baldwin, and much, much more. Converge.